Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What's that thing we do on a Friday? Oh, yeah, figure out what the heck happened all week. We will do that. Also today, acid rain and comic books. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, July the 18th. Good, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It is a Friday in the middle of the month, in the middle of the year, at the end of a busy week. So we will get going with a look back at the events of the past 5 days. Here for our weekly wrapper, John Carney from The Wall Street Journal and Neela Richardson from Redfin. They are in our New York studios. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, John, let me start with you and the chair of the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen. She went up to Capitol Hill this week, for 2 days, rather, of testimony. Standard, you know, economy's getting better, not fast enough, slack in the labor market, blah, blah, blah. And then she said that thing that everybody has keyed on, which is that valuations of social media and biotechnology stocks are, and this is the quote, substantially stretched. In other words, it's Alan Greenspan's version of irrational exuberance, right?
Right. And what this tells you is you should probably rush out and buy social
media stocks.
Because what happened
contrarian
after?
You.
Well, what happened after? Remember, Alan Greenspan's irrational exuberance remark was in 1996.
Yeah.
We had a roaring 5-year bull market following that. If this is that moment, then, you know, Twitter is where you want to be, I guess.
That's a gutsy move, man. Hey, so Neela, so the other thing that happened in regards to that remark is that the next day, Jim Cramer from CNBC was doing a panel with Jack Lew, the Secretary of the Treasury, and he Cramer, asked Secretary Lew whether the chair of the Fed ought to be making remarks about stocks and industry sectors. And Lew basically said, we would really rather she didn't. Should she?
You know what? The Fed is so invested in the stock market right now, implicitly. It's hard not to say something that you have such a heavy hand in. Of course not. Of course the Fed shouldn't be talking about stocks, but they shouldn't really in a normal market be subsidizing them either, and we're having both right now.
Speaking of subsidizing the market, I did an interview this week with Richard Fisher, the president of the Dallas Fed. He came to the studio. We chatted for a good long time. Entertaining speech. He is not wild about our loose and accommodative monetary policy, and he is worried that we are going to overshoot, that the Fed's going to keep money too loose for too long. Here's how he put it. Just listen to this.
Those that do duck hunt aim ahead of the bird in their flight pattern. They don't aim where the bird is currently. And I think we have to be mindful of the fact that monetary policy operates with a lag. We need to aim ahead of the flight pattern, and the flight pattern right now is an economy that is improving more quickly than we expected.
We talked a lot about a lot of different things in that interview, John, bourbon and beer and all kinds of stuff. How big a worry is it that the Fed's going to stay too loose for too long?
I think that as much as I respect Mr. Fisher, mm-hmm. I think that he is frankly, just plain wrong on this. Right now, monetary policy is not extremely loose. The economy
is John,
still.
Come on.
I know
they're like, money is free.
Sure, I know people love to say that, but
it's true.
Well, there's no evidence that the interest rate is lower than it would be if we just had a total free market economy. And so if the natural interest rate is very low, the target interest rate needs to be low, too. It actually may be negative still just based on the kind of growth we saw in the first quarter. Remember, we're still an economy that's kind of rattled and teetering. So I don't think it's extremely accommodative. I think it's maybe appropriate.
Neela, what do you think?
I think the Fed is overworked. There's only so much they can do. There's
We're
only
all
so much to do.
Man.
We are all overworked. And the housing market is still suffering. Remember, part of the value of keeping an accommodative policy is to jumpstart the housing market. And where did the fingers point in terms of the weakest sector performing right now? Housing.
Yeah.
It's not working up to par. It may be time to review and take stock of it.
John, the quantitative easing taper is going to end in October. You all right with that?
I'm not sure that QE was really the most effective policy anyway, so I don't think that will be a big deal. Right. A much bigger deal will be when they start to actually raise rates. That will be a big difference. I just want to say about Mr. Fisher's hunting analogy. Yeah, you need to aim a little ahead of the duck, but if you aim too far, you might shoot the guy standing next to you. You got to get it on target. It's not just that you start shooting right away just because the duck is in the air.
John Carney from The Wall Street Journal and Neela Richardson from Redfin. You guys have a good weekend, all right?
You too, Kai. Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
All right, be good. On Wall Street today, global geopolitical instability. What global geopolitical instability? Come on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's all but certain that the missile system that shot down Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 yesterday was a relic of the Cold War, basically the bottom of a tank with anti-aircraft missiles mounted on top, developed by the Soviet Union back in the 1970s. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has more now on how these old weapon systems are bought and sold and given away around the world across the years.
It's not clear exactly where the Buk missile system that allegedly shot down the passenger jet came from, but there are a few things we can probably say about it.
It was not from some weapon baron. It's from the armed forces, either Ukrainian or Russian.
Igor Sutyagin studies arms control at the Royal United Services Institute in London. He says the Ukrainian military inherited some Buk missiles from the Soviet Union after it collapsed, and it's possible that pro-Russian rebels captured one from the Ukraine army. Another possibility, according to Bruce Bennett, a defense analyst for the RAND Corporation, it could have come from a Russian military commander.
Those commanders may be part of criminal organizations, or they may be operating officially.
There are several hundred Buk missile systems out in the world today in the hands of half a dozen or so countries, Russia, Ukraine, and other former Soviet republics, as well as Syria, which has bought weapons from Russia for years. There's no official registry of where they all are, though the UN does its best to keep a list, and different countries track them through their own intelligence agencies. But Bennett says it's not uncommon for old weapons from Russia and the U.S. to have second and third lives.
Many countries can't afford to purchase brand new items, but which they buy secondhand.
Often perfectly legally. What's impossible to know is how many less conspicuous and smaller old Soviet-era weapons are circulating around the world's conflict zones illegally. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Malaysia Airlines flew its Flight 17 again today, Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It was routed well south of Ukrainian airspace, we should say. A lot of airlines had already been avoiding that area. Others had not. So we asked Marketplace's Mark Garrison to figure out the economics of flight planning.
Airlines use computer modeling and human judgment to choose flight plans. Basically, they look at two things, says aviation consultant George Hamlin.
The first thing is safety. The considerations after that are basically you would like to do that at the lowest possible cost.
A less efficient flight path means more money spent on fuel, crews, and maintenance. So it's not a decision carriers take lightly. Ukrainian authorities had closed the flight path up to 32,000 feet, but flight MH17 was above that. Some airlines still avoided the area altogether, paying more for extra safety. Malaysia Airlines stayed the course, as did several other carriers.
This industry has gotten so dog-eat-dog and so competitive that they're looking at the bottom line far more than they ever have in the history of this industry.
University of Portland finance professor Richard Gritta says a longer flight path may only cost a few dollars more per seat, but multiply that over all the flights and it takes a real bite out of profits.
It becomes a fairly big deal, especially if you're flying that route several times a day.
Strict cost-cutting is why you don't often hear captains of today's commercial jets talk like Jim Tillman.
I've flown hundreds of miles around weather to keep my passengers secure and safe and comfortable.
Tillman was a longtime American Airlines pilot whose career included air travel's golden age.
I did burn a little bit more fuel, but it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't so much that the airline got upset because I did that.
With companies facing high fuel prices and shareholder pressure, pilots today don't expect their employers to be so lenient. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Thor has a tradition of other people holding the hammer and being Thor for a while.
Whatever you do, don't call her Lady Thor. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. On this Friday, the Dow Industrial's up 123 points, 0.75%, closed at 17,100 on the nose. The NASDAQ popped up 68 points, about 1.5%, ended things at 4,432, while the S&P 500 rose 20 points, that is 1%, ended things at 1,978. For the week, the Dow finished up 0.9%. The NASDAQ ended up 0.4% higher. The S&P 500 closed up about 0.5%. Tech stocks led today's rally, fueled by good earnings news from Google, which jumped 3.75%. Apple bobbed up 1.4%. Microsoft gained about 0.3%. General Electric also released earnings today, but fell 0.5%. Honeywell's good earnings earned it a 1.7% gain. In the news, the drug companies AbbVie and Shire have finalized the terms of their merger. Gave both a shot in the arm. AbbVie shares closed up 2.5% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.48%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. On this day in 1861, Union and Confederate troops clash in the first major engagement of the Civil War, the Battle of Bull Run. In 2007, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows became the fastest-selling novel ever published. It sold 15 million copies within 24 hours of its release. And are you in trouble with your loved one? It's time to hug it out, because it's National Get Out of the Doghouse Day. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the day. Tonight, I guess I should say, is the night. The deadline for you to let the Federal Communications Commission know how you feel about net neutrality. You've got until midnight tonight to weigh in on the FCC's plan to create a fast lane on the Internet. Much weighing in has already been done. As of today, the FCC had gotten more than 1 million public comments. And you should know, American Public Media, the company that owns this program, is on the record as opposing any creation of a fast lane online. 1 million is a whole lot of comments. So is anybody going to read them? Marketplace's Annie Baxter has a look at that.
The folks sharing their 2 cents with the FCC include regular people, business owners, and musicians. The band OK Go ganged up with a bunch of other artists to write a letter objecting to parts of the proposed net neutrality rules, which they then posted on the FCC's virtual wall. Lead singer Damian Kulash is worried the rules could crimp the creativity and access to the Internet that let his band flourish.
Our big breakthrough was in a video we made in my backyard for $5. Suddenly a band could get directly to their fans with a massive video that we'd made for almost no money.
The FCC says it's putting extra processes in place so all public input is seriously considered. The agency's commissioner and senior staff get summaries of the comments.
It's the ones that do a detailed analysis of particular issues that will really have the biggest impact.
Law professor Christopher Yu at the University of Pennsylvania doubts that the final version of the rules will be shaped by posts and emails from average Joes.
They will be used by whichever side of the debate it favors as rhetorical flourish.
But Blair Levin, a former chief of staff with the FCC, is more hopeful that every comment counts.
This is obviously one of the issues about which the public cares most that the FCC will be dealing with.
And Levin notes there's still a lot that has to be hashed out with the proposed rules, which the FCC hopes to finalize by year's end. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Something like 255 million people log on to Twitter every month, which is a big number, but it's not going fast enough to satisfy Twitter's investors. So now the Wall Street Journal reports the company is considering new ways to measure that audience to convince shareholders that the world of people who engage with Twitter is bigger than the world that logs on. Kate Davidson has more.
Sean Patil says when you're analyzing a social network, which is part of what he does for Wedbush Securities,
there are only two things that you care about, the number of users and the level of engagement.
Twitter describes those now with two metrics, monthly active users and timeline views. But there's a problem, says Brian Weiser of Pivotal Research Group.
The problem is that Twitter, surprise, surprise, isn't for everyone.
Growth in users and engagement slowed from 2013 to 2014, but plenty of non-tweeters still interact with tweets. Say you're a sports fan, says Sean Patil.
So, you know, if I'm reading a story about how LeBron James is going back to Cleveland,
tweets from LeBron might be embedded in the article.
So that would be, you know, me engaging with Twitter, but not really signed on.
So my mom doesn't send tweets, but she'd see and hear them if we watched celebrities read mean tweets on Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Kelly Ripa is kind of amazing when you think about how hard it must be to balance that huge head on a tiny body.
The new metrics would reportedly capture that wider audience, though Twitter declined to comment. Analyst Brian Weiser says he thinks all this focus on users distracts from
the fact that they've got a great business. Metrics that would tell a much better story are things like, how many advertisers do they have? What is the average spend per advertiser?
Things that speak more to Twitter's source of business than the number of people who see tweets. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
We told you yesterday in our series, We Used to Be China, how acid rain went from the biggest environmental issue of the 1980s to barely being on our radar screens today. Sulfur dioxide from power plants, one of the biggest causes of acid rain, is down more than 70%. That happened because of an unlikely coalition of politicians, environmentalists, and industry. Dan Bobkoff takes us back to a time when things actually got done in Washington.
Scientists first discovered acid rain in the U.S. in 1963. By the 70s, they'd shown it was caused mainly by sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides coming out of power plants. But no one did much about it until 1989.
I even said to people it was like all the planets aligning.
This is Brian McLean. He was with the Environmental Protection Agency back then. And he's one player in a surprising group who worked together to get a new Clean Air Act proposed, written, and passed in mere months.
The political and the interest groups, industry, environmentalists, but particularly the political leadership in both branches of government coming together at an unusual time.
It turns out the 1988 election is a really big deal. This guy is elected.
I, George Herbert Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
President Bush wants to break with his predecessor Ronald Reagan and prove a Republican can be serious about the environment. The Senate leadership shifts too. A Democrat from Maine, George Mitchell, replaces Robert Byrd, a Democrat from West Virginia, as majority leader.
Those two senators represented states who were on the opposite sides of this issue.
West Virginia is coal country, supplying Midwest power plants. It's responsible for much of the acid rain falling on states like Maine. So with new politicians in charge, Boyd and Gray on Bush's transition team calls a meeting at the White House.
Boyden invited us in.
Dan Dudek is there. He's with the Environmental Defense Fund. And he's an economist, which is important to our story.
When President Bush was elected, wanted to make good on his promise of becoming the environmental president, we said, hey, solve the acid rain problem. That'll certainly quiet the critics.
Well, we were already focused on acid rain, so I don't know that they tipped the balance on that.
This is Boyden Gray himself. So acid rain is now a priority. And Dudek has an idea that he thinks might just bring together Republicans and Democrats, environmentalists and industry. He pitches it to Gray at that meeting.
You could do it in an incredibly novel way. You could actually set up a market.
Well, that's what broke the logjam, was the market approach.
The idea is this. The government sets a limit on the amount of sulfur dioxide that can be released in a year. Power companies are told how much they can emit. It's up to them to decide how to get to those levels, maybe install scrubbers or switch to a different kind of coal. If they cut more than their allowance, they could sell the excess to a power company struggling to meet its limit. It became known as cap and trade. This isn't the kind of idea power companies are used to hearing from government. Gary Hart was with the big utility Southern Company at the time, and he first hears about it at a coal conference.
And I kind of casually walked over to the office after the conference and said, guys, you won't believe what I just heard.
Southern Company, like many utilities, was initially fiercely opposed. It was the fear of the unknown, he says. But behind the scenes, Hart and his team watched the drafts closely, calculating how much each would cost the company. Meanwhile, Brian McLean at EPA is writing the White House's plan as fast as possible.
That's all I did for 5 or 6 months, day and night. We worked on these things, and we got it up there. And I remember the first day we were outside, and there was sun. You know, I hadn't seen the sun in that many months.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Finally, in steamy July of 1989, President Bush unveils the plan in the White House Rose Garden.
The Clean Air Act that I'm sending to Congress today has been made possible.
And it worked, better than even many supporters predicted. Some companies overcorrected so they could make money selling allowances. Emissions fell faster and more cheaply than planned. The act called for emissions to be reduced by half, but today, sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides emissions are down more than 70% since the 80s. In the end, the program won over environmentalists who thought it was too lenient on industry, an industry that expected it to be expensive. And Gary Hart says it worked partly because all the sides more or less got along.
People that you thought would be natural enemies, like the Southern Company and EPA, you were finding us working together because we really wanted to make this work.
Nearly everyone I talked to for this story says that spirit is gone today. If acid rain had happened 30 years later, they say, the Clean Air Act and its cap-and-trade program wouldn't exist. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
If you somehow missed part of our series, We Used to Be China, it's all online. The stories, the slideshows, and all those smog pictures you guys sent in. It's marketplace.org. This has been the week, it would seem, for news about comic books. We told you a couple of days ago about the death of Archie Andrews. And there was news as well from Marvel, the folks behind the Avengers and Spider-Man, to name just a couple. First of all, Thor, the big burly Norwegian one with the hammer, is going to be a woman. And Captain America is going to be black. It's a bit of a sea change for an industry that has historically had no shortage of white guys on its pages. Will Moss is an editor at Marvel for the Thor series. Will, thanks for coming on.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I'm going to quote you to yourself in this press release. You say the inscription on Thor's hammer reads, "Whosoever holds this hammer, if he be worthy, shall possess the power of Thor." Well, you said it is time to update that inscription.
Right.
How come?
Well, it all really came from the writer, Jason Aaron. The story, he's been writing Thor for about 2 years now, and it just kind of sprung from where he was taking the character. Thor has a tradition of other people holding the hammer and being Thor for a while.
And she then becomes one of the Avengers?
Well, yes. More than likely she will.
What do you mean,
but it's
well, not, yes? You don't know yet?
For right now, she's just figuring things out. Like,
well, it's got to be tough, right? Somebody says to you, hey, you're Thor now, and here you go.
Yeah, Thor doesn't actually give her the title. She finds his hammer. He's unable to lift up his hammer, and this mysterious woman picks it up. So for a while, Thor's not even sure who she is. I'm sorry, the old Thor's not even right. Sure who she is.
See, even you're confused.
Thor is now simply Odin's son. That's how
Odin's
he's going
son.
By.
Yeah, the son of Odin, right, of course.
Exactly. It's like his last name, basically.
On a related but I get completely different comic book universe, Captain America now is going to be a black guy, we learned the other day.
That's right. Sam Wilson, the Falcon, yeah. Is his partner, is taking over for Captain America.
So Marvel Comics is just changing all things up.
But again, even that is something that came from the writer of that title. It just happens to be around the same time. So we've kind of found a way to, you know, package it all together at once.
Acknowledging that this isn't necessarily your bailiwick, I wonder, and I guess evidence would be that you're on the radio now with me, I wonder how the folks who are in charge of business strategy and marketing at Marvel Comics feel about this.
Well, I think, right. I can't necessarily speak to that, but this is something that is bringing attention. It's bringing new readers. It's bringing new eyes. That's how we look at it. It's just a way to broaden our audience, to make characters that more people would be interested in, to reach different groups of people.
What happens if it doesn't work, man?
Well, it's a risk with any story. I mean, any story we tell, there's a risk, I guess, that it might not take. But we've got a lot of faith in the writers and the artists that we work with. And so we roll the dice on anything. But because of that faith we have in them, we usually have, you know, pretty good returns.
Can the comic book consuming public expect the same kind of Thor stories now that she's a she instead of a he?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. It's going to be right off the bat, she's going to be fighting frost giants from the Nine Realms. I mean, she's getting right into the thick of things, doing the same kind of stuff that Odinson used to do when he still had the hammer.
Will, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks.
Will Moss, he is an editor at Marvel Comics, talking about Thor being a she.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which you and your smartphone play a leading role. The good people at Nielsen did some measuring of how many apps we use on a regular basis. I'll give you a second here because there are lots of categories to think about, right? News, travel, entertainment, finance. All right, here you go. We all, on average, use 26.8 apps per month on a regular basis. There seems to be a natural cap of 30. No age group uses that many apps on a regular basis. Also, just to close the loop from our interview yesterday about the business of scent, here are some of your thoughts on what this program smells like, which is what we talked about yesterday. Money, of course. A lot of you suggested that. Wall Street, small town Main Street, and an economics classroom was part of another one. Here is my personal favorite. Surfboard wax and Fed transcripts. I love that one. Keep them coming. We're at Marketplace on Twitter. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl, and we are on Facebook as well. And with that, we gotta go. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you Monday. Surfboard wax? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.